We come to the 22nd chapter in Essays on the Gita. This appeared in the 15th May 1918 issue of the Arya. The first piece in the issue was, of course, The Life Divine, Rebirth. Then came this essay, which was in 1918 titled Beyond the Gunas. After that, Synthesis of Yoga, The Motives of Devotion. So we find that he opens this chapter with a discussion of the Sankhyan view of nature and determinism and the ego's enmeshment with a fictional selfhood in the throes of cosmic development. So you can see that Sri Aurobindo, having changed the title from Beyond the Gunas to Beyond the Modes of Nature, as in a sense intentionally taken it both within and outside the context of Indian thought. So we begin with Sankhya. Sankhya, which means enumeration or the counting out of the principles of existence, natural principles of existence. And later he will refine, but he begins with the discussion of an element of developing nature, the ego, which in the Sankhya system is called the Ahankara, the I maker. So far, then, extends the determinism of nature. And what it amounts to is this, that the ego from which we act is itself an instrument of the action of Prakriti and cannot therefore be free from the control of Prakriti. The will of the ego is a will determined by Prakriti. It is a part of the nature as it has been formed in us by the sum of its own past action and self-modification, and by the nature in us so formed, and the will in it so formed, our present action also is determined. It is said by some that the first initiating action is always free to our choice, however much all that follows may be determined by that. And in this power of initiation and its effect on our future lies our responsibility. But where is that first action in nature, which has no determining past behind it? Where that present condition of our nature, which is not in sum and detail the result of the action of our past nature? We have that impression of a free initial act because we are living at every moment from our present on towards our future, and we do not live back constantly from our present into our past, so that what is strongly vivid to our minds is the present and its consequences, while we have a much less vivid hold of our present as entirely the consequence of our past. This latter we are apt to look on as if it were dead and done with. We speak and act as if we were perfectly free in the pure and virgin moment to do what we will with ourselves using an absolute inward independence of choice. But there is no such absolute liberty. Our choice has no such independence. So this is common to all modes of philosophy which approach the world materialistically. What fixation can you put at a point of beginning, and where would an end be? So all phenomena occurring within the phenomenon of the universe are essentially beginningless. Everything conditions everything else. There would be no ability for any agency to really exist within the context of the universal action. All would be affected by prakriti, by nature itself. The ego would have no free will, no capacity to determine its own present or future, apart from the context. So, we find, of course, the determinism in philosophy in the West, as we've talked about earlier, to be much the same thing. In fact, we'll have a chance to touch upon it in a bit, because in previous writings, we noted that the idea of determinism didn't arrive until the 19th century in Western philosophy, because it was really brought up to distinguish the view of Thomas Hobbes and his view of how things were determined in the world as apart from the idea of fatalism in ancient Greek philosophy. But of that in a moment. Sri Aurobindo continues, certainly the will in us has always to choose between a certain number of possibilities, for that is the way in which nature always acts. Even our passivity, our refusal to will, is itself a choice, itself an act of the will of nature in us. Even in the atom, there is a will always at its work. This is, of course, core to Democritus and his philosophy in ancient Greece. Note that Arjuna, at the beginning of this contest on the battlefield, doesn't want to fight. He's going to resist his nature, but he can't. Ultimately, he must obey his nature. He must fight because he is the born Kshatriya, the man of the hour, the man of the age, and he can't quit. That has already been determined in him. Arjuna has to have the veil lifted from his eyes by Krishna as to why he must. And this is what Krishna is doing now, explaining the inner workings of nature, and that you are not the you you think you are, Arjuna. The whole difference, he writes, is the extent to which we associate our idea of self with the action of the will in nature. When we so associate ourselves, we think of it as our will and say that it is a free will and that it is we who are acting. And, error or not, illusion or not, this idea of our will, of our action, is not a thing of no consequence, of no utility. Everything in nature has a consequence and a utility. It is rather that process of our conscious being by which nature in us becomes more and more aware of and responsive to the presence of the secret Purusha within her and opens by that increase of knowledge to a greater possibility of action. It is by the aid of the ego idea and the personal will that she raises herself to her own higher possibilities, rises out of the sheer or else the predominant passivity of the tamasic nature into the passion and the struggle of the rajasic nature, and from the passion and the struggle of the rajasic nature to the greater light, happiness, and purity of the sattvic nature. So the notion of having free will compels us from level to level. We think we're a free agent, and that energizes us to rise out of tamas and to strive. We become rajasic. We work hard at that, and then we rise from the rajasic to the sattvic level. So we're climbing the grades of nature, and Sri Aurobindo will have us arrive at the height of the Purusha in just a moment. The relative self-mastery, gained by the natural man over himself is the dominion achieved by their higher possibilities of his nature over its lower possibilities. And this is done in him when he associates his idea of self with the struggle of the higher guna to get the mastery, the predominance over the lower guna. So Rajas tries to overcome the inertia of tamas. Sattva tries to overcome the sheer passion and energy of Rajas. I think I said that correctly. The sense of free will, illusion or not, is a necessary machinery of the action of nature, necessary for man during his progress, and it would be disastrous for him to lose it before he is ready for a higher truth. If it be said, as it has been said, that nature deludes man to fulfill her behests, and that the idea of a free individual will is the most powerful of these delusions, then it must also be said that the delusion is for his good, and without it he could not rise to his full possibilities. Remember, there is secret and promising inside the machinery of Prakriti, which seems to be inconscient nature, an avenue for deliverance. We are driven up from gross identification with matter and all that is dull, jada, dead, and pushed upwards through energy until we arrive at light. Prakriti is trying to deliver us, trying to evolve us, to use a modern term, so that we can rest free of our lower chains. She doesn't want us, as we develop the power of consciousness, to rest in the entrails of existence. She wants us to rise to the summits. But it is not a sheer delusion. It is only an error of standpoint and an error of placement. The ego thinks that it is the real self and acts as if it were the true center of action and as if all existed for its sake. And there it commits an error of standpoint and placement. You'll remember Sri Aurobindo speaking in The Life Divine about the seven levels of ignorance and what the solution to them is. And of course, context is all, always. It is not wrong in thinking that there is something or someone within ourselves, within this action of our nature, who is the true center of its action and for whom all exists. But this is not the ego. It is the Lord, secret within our hearts, the divine Purusha and the Jiva. Other than ego, who is a portion of his being. This is Bhagavad Gita, chapter 15, shloka 7. Let's read it in translation if we can. It is an eternal, sanatana. It is an eternal portion of me. The Lord is speaking here. It is an eternal portion of me that becomes the jiva in the world of living creatures and cultivates the subjective powers of Prakriti, mind, and the five senses. Or you can translate it differently and say that he becomes the jiva in the world of living creatures and draws to itself all from the mind and the senses. So there is a power at work. The jiva, the seed of true individuality, is identical with the Supreme Person. That is the great central fire, that divine person. But you are the spark, true to it, cognate with it. And that is the truth of your being. You're not the ego, but the ego is the first assertion of selfhood in the play of nature. Allowable for that. We have to get used to being here. And then later we can reveal who we are. The self-assertion of ego sense is the broken and distorted shadow in our minds of the truth that there is a real self within us, which is the master of all, and for whom and at whose behest nature goes about her works. So too, the ego's idea of free will is a distorted and misplaced sense of the truth that there is a free self within us and that the will in nature is only a modified and partial reflection of its will. Modified and partial because it lives in the successive moments of time and acts by a constant series of modifications which forget much of their own precedence and are only imperfectly conscious of their own consequences and aims. Remember how we forget where we were when we started? We have no memory of it. We just are suddenly here now, and by golly, we exist. It's so funny. But really, we are that eternal being, Sanatana, and Amsha, a portion, Sanatana Amsha, of the Supreme. That's what we really are. But the will within, and note he capitalizes will. This is not the will of the ego here. This is not the will as expressed in the ordinary machinery of nature. But the will within, exceeding the moments of time, knows all these. And the action of nature in us is an attempt, we might say, to work out under the difficult conditions of a natural and egoistic ignorance what is foreseen in full supramental light by the inner will and knowledge. So he's strongly suggesting here that the divine Purusha, Purushottama, above, Jiva coming from Purushottama, exists in the higher nature, Paraprakriti, the supreme nature, and expresses its will in a hidden way, but a felt way in this universe. Up there, we can live in the full supramental light and see what it is that's trying to work out here. So there is the dominance of Prakriti by Paraprakriti, the dominance of nature by supernature. So this metaphysical note, I think, is necessary to get the meaning of what he's trying to tell us here. Because as we mentioned last time, if free will exists for us, it's in the power of the soul fully awake to itself and allowing to flood down in a cascading of flatus from above the light of the superconscience, which wishes to express itself and fix itself in nature. And it is there that we have freedom. Otherwise, as long as we're identified with this bit of machinery that we seem to govern and possess, then that identification is the signature of our ignorance, and that we still don't remember, still don't live in communion with that which we secretly and permanently are. Back to his essay. But a time must come in our progress when we are ready to open our eyes to the real truth of our being. And then the error of our egoistic free will must fall away from us. The rejection of the idea of egoistic free will does not imply a cessation of action, because nature is the doer and carries out her action after this machinery is dispensed with, even as she did before it came into usage in the process of her evolution. In the man who has rejected it, it may even be possible for her to develop a greater action. For his mind may be more aware of all that his nature is by the self-creation of the past, more aware of the powers that environ and are working upon it to help or to hinder its growth, more aware, too, of the latent greater possibilities which it contains by virtue of all in it that is unexpressed yet capable of expression. And this mind may be a freer channel for the sanction of the Purusha to the greater possibilities that it sees, and a freer instrument for the response of nature for her resultant attempt at their development and realization. But the rejection of free will must not be a mere fatalism or idea of natural determinism in the understanding without any vision of the real self in us. For then the ego still remains as our sole idea of self, and as that is always the instrument of Prakriti, we still act by the ego and with our will as her instrument. And the idea in us brings no real change, but only a modification of our intellectual attitude. So again, he invites us to realization. So, fatalism, all things happen according to an unbending fate. A natural determinism means that, according to nature, it happened the only way it could. It could not have happened otherwise. Well, that has nothing to do with the power of the soul, awakening within, descending from above. There is the possibility of free will, but only when we are self-realized. Capital S, not lowercase s. We shall have accepted the phenomenal truth of the determination of our egoistic being and action by nature. We shall have seen our subjection, but we shall not have seen the unborn self within, which is above the action of the gunas. We shall not have seen wherein lies our gate of freedom. Nature and ego are not all we are. There is the free soul, the Purusha. So again, it isn't enough to think about it. It isn't enough to philosophize and understand intellectually how these principles fit together in this tight machinery and metaphysical system. No, we have to awaken. Yes, really awaken. And that requires tapasya, the application of effort. He continues, and while we've been relatively free of citations for shlokas, get ready in case you care. But in what consists this freedom of the Purusha of the current Sankhya philosophy, is free in the essence of his being, but because he is the non-doer, akarta, that's 4.13, and again 13.29. And insofar as he permits nature to throw on the inactive soul her shadow of action, he becomes bound phenomenally by the actions of the gunas and cannot recover his freedom except by dissociation from her and by cessation of her activities. Purusha has to divorce from Prakriti. If then a man casts from him the idea of himself as the doer or of the works as his, if, as the Gita enjoins, he fixes himself in the view of himself as the inactive non-doer, atmanam akartaram, and all action as not his own but nature's, as the play of her gunas, will not a like result follow? This goes back to 13.29. Upadrashta anumanta, the onlooker and the consenter. The Sankhya Purusha is the giver of the sanction, but a passive sanction only on the mati. The work is entirely nature's. Essentially, he is the witness and sustainer, not the governing and active consciousness of the universal Godhead. That's 1322, by the way. He is the soul that sees and accepts, as a spectator accepts the representation of a play he is watching, not the soul that both governs and watches the play, planned by himself and staged in his own being. If then he withdraws the sanction, if he refuses to acknowledge the illusion of doing by which the play continues, he ceases also to be the sustainer, and the action comes to a stop, since it is only for the pleasure of the witnessing conscious soul that nature performs it, and only by his support that she can maintain it. This is the classical view of Sankhya here. As long as Purusha is willing to watch, nature will perform. If Purusha ceases to watch or withdraws consent, refuses to look again, then the dance of nature ends. Period. It's over. I think I read this sentence, but I'll read it again. If then he withdraws the sanction, if he refuses to acknowledge the illusion of doing by which the play continues, he ceases also to be the sustainer, and the action comes to a stop, since it is only for the pleasure of the witnessing conscious soul that nature performs it, and only by his support that she can maintain it. And so here Sri Aurobindo divides. That's the classical view of Sankhya. It is not the view of the Gita, Sri Aurobindo will assert. Therefore, it is evident that the Gita's conception of the relations of the Purusha and Prakriti are not the Sankhya's, since the same movement leads to a quite different result. In one case, to cessation of works, in the other, to a great, a selfless and desireless, a divine action. The cessation is typical Sankhya. The divine action is the Gita's Sankhya. In the Sankhya, soul and nature are two different entities. In the Gita, they are two aspects, two powers of one self-existent being. In the Upanishads, this would be called the Swayambhu. The soul is not only giver of the sanction, but lord of nature, Ishwara, through her enjoying the play of the world, through her executing divine will and knowledge in a scheme of things supported by his sanction and existing by his immanent presence, existing in his being, governed by the law of his being and by the conscious will within it. To know, to respond to live in the divine being and nature of this soul is the object of withdrawing from the ego and its action. One rises then above the lower nature of the gunas to the higher divine nature. That's para prakriti. So this is the means of ascent. The difficult passage, perhaps, but the way by which the yogin, who knows, loves, and dedicates through work himself in all action, arrives at transference from the lower to the higher. Without, might I say, abandoning the lower, it hints at transformation, doesn't it? The movement by which this ascension is determined results from the complex poise of the soul in its relations with nature. It depends on the Gita's idea of the triple Purusha. The soul that immediately informs the action, the mutations, the successive becomings of nature is the Kshara, that which seems to change with her changes, to move in her motion. The person who follows in his idea of his being the changes of his personality brought about by the continuous action of her karma. Nature here is Kshara, a constant movement and mutation in time, a constant becoming. But this nature is simply the executive power of the soul itself. For only by what he is can she become. Only according to the possibilities of his becoming can she act. She works out the becoming of his being. Her karma is determined by Swabhava, the own nature, the law of self-becoming of the soul, even though, because it is the agent and executive of the becoming, the action rather seems to determine the nature. So there are two shlokas I'd like to bring your attention to. The first is chapter 8, shloka 3, and the second is chapter 18, shloka 60. In chapter 8, shloka 3, it says, Swabhavaha Adhyatmam. The oversoul is the inner nature. Swabhava, remember, is that which is identified with the jiva and para prakriti. So it really belongs to the higher sphere. It is that which, through the Swadharma, fixes and determines the course of action here in the triple world of the gunas. But that is above. And in 1860, Swabhava Jena, born of your own nature, in para prakriti, and acting here via Swadharma. So that is one of the great closing quotes. We'll, of course, probably cite it many times as we approach. But the idea of Swabhava is not simple and is often overlooked. This really is a thread that ties the metaphysics from above to how we act in nature here. So how does the Supreme Nature act here? Secretly, always, through the connection of the immanent divine, who expresses as the jiva through the Swabhava into Swadharma. Back to his essay. According to what we are, we act. And by our action, we develop. We work out what we are. Nature is the action, the mutation, the becoming. And it is the power that executes all these. Power with a capital P. So this is no ordinary power. But the soul is the conscious being from which that power proceeds. So it is the sat from which chit acts and upon which it bases itself. From whose luminous stuff of consciousness she has drawn the variable will that changes and expresses its changes in her actions. And this soul is one and many. It is the one life being out of which all life is constituted. And it is all these living beings. It is the cosmic existent. And it is all this multitude of cosmics. And it is all this multitude of cosmic existences, sarva bhutani, for all these are one. All the many purushas are in their original being, the one and only purusha. Let's note that this term has special application for us here in chapter 6, shloka 29, and especially in chapter 9, shloka 7. And if you look at 9:7, you'll see that Ishvara, as Krishna, says that all sarva bhutani, all beings, are sent forth anew in the next world cycle. In other words, whatever seems to come into being and go out of being, what they are essentially, never goes away, but they populate universe after universe after universe. So there is a complete recycling of these conscious souls. Nobody is lost. If there is an illusion, it is death. Back to Sri Aurobindo's essay. But the mechanism of the ego sense in nature, which is part of her action, induces the mind to identify the soul's consciousness with the limited becoming of the moment, with the sum of her active consciousness in a given field of space and time, with the result from moment to moment of the sum of her past actions. So here, in just a few sentences, Sri Aurobindo has again sketched the whole of existence, from the transcendence, from pure, true being, into cosmic station, and then the individual working within the cosmos, with the sense that it exists separately from the context of the universe, forgetful of the transcendent oneness from which it came. Any wonder that the puzzle is difficult to solve? It is possible to realize in a way the unity of all these beings, even in nature herself, and to become aware of a cosmic soul which is manifest in the whole action of cosmic nature. Nature manifesting the soul constituting the nature. But this is to become aware only of the great cosmic becoming, which is not false or unreal, but the knowledge of which alone does not give us the true knowledge of ourself. For our true self is always something more than this and something beyond it. We have to go home. We have to find the transcendence, the true being, the self of selves, Paramatman, Purushottama, and there, we really are one with everything. So I think that's a very good place to set a bookmark. Let me see if I can remember where I wanted to read from. And Savitri. I think we can begin in book one, the book of beginnings, in canto four, the secret knowledge. And if I am repeating a section that I've read earlier, then I'll continue next time. But I think this is where I wanted to start. Let me start on page 64. Towards the bottom of the page. His soul is a subtle atom in a mass. His substance, a material for her works. His spirit survives amid the death of things. He climbs to eternity through being's gaps. He is carried by her from night to deathless light. This grand surrender is his free will's gift. His pure transcendent force submits to hers. In the mystery of her cosmic ignorance, in the insoluble riddle of her play, a creature made of perishable stuff, in the pattern she has set for him, he moves. He thinks with her thoughts. With her trouble, his bosom heaves. He seems the thing that she would have him seem. He is whatever her artist will can make. Although she drives him on her fancy's roads, at play with him as with her child or slave, to freedom and the eternal's mastery and immortality stand above the world, she moves her seeming puppet of an hour. Even in his mortal session in body's house, an aimless traveler between birth and death, ephemeral, dreaming of immortality, to reign she spurs him. He takes up her powers. He has harnessed her to the yoke of her own law. His face of human thought puts on a crown. Held in her leash, bound to her veiled caprice, he studies her ways, if so he may prevail even for an hour, and she work out his will. He makes of her his moment passion's serf. To obey she feigns, she follows her creature's lead. For him she was made, lives only for his use. But conquering her, then is he most her slave. He is her dependent. All his means are hers. Nothing without her he can. She rules him still. At last he wakes to a memory of self. He sees within the face of deity. The godhead breaks out through the human mold. Her highest heights she unmasks and is his mate. Till then, he is a plaything in her game, her seeming regent, yet her fancy's toy, a living robot moved by her energy's springs. He acts as in the movements of a dream, an automaton stepping in the grooves of fate. He stumbles on, driven by her whip of force. His thought labors, a bullock in time's fields. His will, he thinks his own, is shaped in her forge. Obedient to world nature's dumb control, driven by his own formidable power, his chosen partner in a titan game, her will he has made the master of his fate, her whim the dispenser of his pleasure and pain. He has sold himself into her regal power for any blow or boon that she may choose. Even in what is suffering to our sense, he feels the sweetness of her mastering touch. In all experience, meets her blissful hands. On his heart, he bears the happiness of her tread and the surprise of her arrival's joy in each event and every moment's chance. All she can do is marvelous in his sight. He revels in her, a swimmer in her sea, a tireless amateur of her world delight. He rejoices in her every thought and act, and gives consent to all that she can wish. Whatever she desires, he wills to be. The Spirit, the innumerable one, he has left behind his lone eternity. He is an endless birth in endless time, her finite's multitude in an infinite space. Namaste, Jai Ma.